Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College online journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on the War Room podcast today. I'm Jacqueline Witt, Professor of Strategy at the U.S. Army War College and the War Room podcast editor. I hope you're all staying warm as the days get shorter and as lights and decorations start to dot the landscape, at least here in the U.S. Today we're bringing you a special podcast for the holiday season, and we turn our attention to Operation Christmas Drop, a tradition in the United States Air Force that dates back to 1952. With me today is Colonel Buck Habrichter, an officer in the United States Air Force, a faculty member at the Army War College, and longtime C-130 pilot. So, Buck, welcome to the War Room.
Thanks, Jackie. Good to be back.
Excellent. So I want you, basically, to tell us a Christmas story. How does Operation Christmas Drop get started?
All right. Well, like you said, let's go back to 1952. It's the Christmas season. It's Guam, Anderson Air Force Base, and a WB-29 aircraft has just taken off, attached to the 54th Weather Reconnaissance Squadron. And as they're heading south, they fly over the Kapinimarenge Atoll. And as they're flying along, they happen to see the islanders down there on what little bit of ground there is in the middle of the ocean, and they're waving up to them. And they get the bright idea to kind of circle for a moment. They gather up whatever supplies they've got, and they make a makeshift little parachute, and they drop out supplies to them. And that is the first Operation Christmas Drop, and that's how it all began.
So it begins literally by a good idea that some guys have on an airplane.
Absolutely.
And so how does it evolve? Because now it's been continually operating since then, is that right?
So this will be its 66th year. It is, in fact, the DOD's longest-running humanitarian operation. It now uses, instead of WB-29s, and I couldn't tell you what aircraft in the meantime along the way has been used, but at this point, it's now C-130s. Specifically, it was the 36th Airlift Squadron out of Yokota Air Base. And as recently as 2015, the Royal Australian Air Force has sent aircraft, as well as the Japanese Self-Defense Force. And they've now participated in the process as well. Obviously, first and foremost, it's no longer a pickup game. It is a huge operation. There is a civilian organization on Guam that gathers donations throughout the year. They've got their own Facebook page. It is a year-round process by which they're gathering all this for the culmination, obviously, that happens every December. In fact, it's getting ready to kick off on December 11th this year for the 2017 drops and start all over again.
Very good. So it is a training mission for U.S. service members. Is that right?
Well, it's dual in many ways. So it provides excellent training for a number of U.S. service members and obviously now coalition force members as well. But at the same time, it is a humanitarian mission. And one of the great things about this is that it's training in the midst of a real-world mission, and it's a real-world mission in the midst of training. It works out both ways.
And it sounds like it also involves sort of local communities on Guam, because the drop actually happens not on Guam, right?
But right.
On teeny tiny specks of island in the vast Pacific Ocean.
What was once a single island, a single atoll at least, the Kapinimarenge, has grown now into the Commonwealth of Northern Marianas, Federated States of Micronesia, and actually the Republic of Palau as well. And part of the greatness of this operation was always saying all the names of all the islands that you're going out to, because you're going out to Pohnpei, and you're going to Kazre, and Chuk, and Yap, and Palau, and they're all interesting names to go to, as well as incredible sights. And I'll talk about that in a minute. I'll relay some of my experiences with it 20-some years ago. But it's amazing use of military and government equipment, all done legally, through something called the Denton Program, which allows humanitarian supplies to be moved on space-available military transport. That generates an incredible amount of goodwill, and at the same time exercises plans and training skills and organizations that would be activated in the midst of a typhoon or some other natural disaster that could be applied anywhere around the world.
Sure, because humanitarian assistance and disaster relief is certainly one of the things that's a major focus for PACOM, but for combatant commands really all over the world, as we see an increase, maybe an increase in natural disasters, but certainly an increase in the impact of natural disasters for human populations. Do you have a sense of how the mission evolves from a good idea that happens on the back of an aircraft to what it is now? How does it get sort of formalized and bureaucratized and
So unfortunately, the history is kind of sketchy from that 1952 point to modern day. And obviously, I can go back about 20 years of my own experience, but it's just kind of become an institution that has simply grown by force of will in many ways. The military obviously sees great utility in it and the training that we receive. The local communities obviously see great utility in being able to transport their supplies that they've donated out to needy. Needy is a poor word. Folks out on islands who are very remote and often don't see a ship but once a year, who are in need of some of these supplies on some of these very, very small islands that are made up of volcanic ash in many cases, not even a soil that they could plant in a lot of times. So, yeah, I can't tell you exactly how it got to where it is, but it's just something that's always been.
Okay, so you mentioned the Denton.
The Denton program is something that I believe State Department and USAID is involved with it, as well as DOD, and it's a formalized program that it legally authorizes the movement of humanitarian supplies on space-available military transport.
Okay. So what we see here is a really interesting sort of confluence of defense assets and capabilities with local communities, with the interagency, with formalized programs and processes, but also this idea of informal will, that there are, in fact, traditions and things that get done just because it's what gets done. Can you tell us a little bit more about your own experiences with Operation Christmas Drop? You said that was about 20 years
ago. I was stationed at Yokota Air Base. I was in the 36th Airlift Squadron. And it was a great a privilege to be a part of the Christmas Drops every year to go out and do that. It was easily the most enjoyable and most rewarding peacetime missions I'd ever done. Not only are you down in beautiful Guam, you're out flying over some incredible sights. I mean, amazingly blue, clear water. You're seeing tiny little islands that shouldn't exist anywhere. You're seeing amazing shipwrecks that are just stranded in time out there that just would amaze you as you're flying low level over all of this stuff. And then you get to go out and do some very challenging airdrops to some fields that don't have designated drop zones, that don't have a lot of pre-coordinated information to them in a lot of cases. And you have to, in many cases, make up on the fly what your tactics are going to be to coming in to make those drops happen. I should say, for starters, that the drops are all accomplished with condemned chutes. So these are chutes that can't be used anymore for actual military drops or training drops. So they're not going to be recovered. It's not a problem. They're going to get wet and they're going to get soaked. And in fact, they're a great commodity on the islands once they do recover these drops. The bundles we're kicking out the back of the plane are about 400 pounds. They're full of anything from medical supplies, scuba, snorkeling gear, toys, potting soil. You wouldn't necessarily think about that, but again, on a little island made of volcanic ash, potting soil and pots are a great treasure to have to be able to grow some of your own food and plants. We typically have a crew member in the back of the plane dressed up as Santa Claus on a harness that's waving from the tailgate to the kids, because there are obviously many little kids out there on the islands. And each drop is its own challenge, and it's different the way it comes in. The way it happens is whoever controls the HF radio on the island is the one that controls where the drop is going to happen, which can be interesting sometimes, because often there are big enough islands that are several communities on it that maybe disagree about who should control the bundle. I remember one year in particular, we came in and we made the call. We had designated call signs we were calling into, and they called back to us and they said, "We want you to drop it at the south end of the island." We said, "Okay, we need a flag." And they said, "We don't have a flag, we'll give you a mirror flash." And we said, "All right, give us a mirror flash in 3, 2, 1. And the entire island lit up with mirror flashes, like watching the paparazzi on the red carpet. So, yeah, we had to readjust on that one pretty quickly. And in the end, they did manage to come up with a flag, and they put it on the east side of the island in a small inlet, and we were able to do the drop there. And we let them kind of work out who it was that was going to control the bundle that year.
Once it's out of the plane, it's a local issue.
Yep.
Very good. Could you talk a little bit about your interpretation of what Operation Christmas Drop maybe tells us about the U.S. military or about the U.S. Air Force in particular? Does this tell us a cultural story or an institutional story that's worth understanding and knowing?
I think it says several things. First off, for the Air Force, I think it points to the readiness levels that we maintain amongst our air crew members, amongst all the ground support, amongst everyone that's associated with it. And as a young man, I failed to recognize anything beyond what was going on inside my aircraft, but the fuelers, the marshalling yard, the riggers, everybody on the ground that was associated with this, and I've left out all kinds of names there, are all energized in this process, and they're all training for their mission as well in terms of what a disaster relief scenario would look like. So the readiness of the Air Force, I think, is one thing right off the bat that is a mindset that we maintain, especially in the mobility forces as we do. I think it says a great thing about the ability to train and operate in a real-world environment at the same time. And as I said earlier, they both support each other, vice versa. It works very well. I like the fact that humanitarian mission has always been a part of the military toolkit. I mean, it's always something that we are prepared to do on behalf of the nation. It doesn't matter if we're talking about in the continental U.S. or if we're talking about some tiny little remote island in the middle of the Pacific somewhere or another nation that we've obviously helped on many occasions. So I think it says great things about the spirit of the service, of the DOD, and our willingness to reach out and help people when we can help.
Yeah, that military power isn't just kicking doors in and breaking things and killing bad guys. There's a whole lot of other things that go on,
right?
In addition to,
yep,
perhaps the kicking down of
doors. And so I mentioned earlier about the condemned chutes. This has now been formalized into a program through the Army because the Army controls all airdrop operations in terms of how they're doctrinized and everything that goes with that.
Doctrinized? Did you just make up a word?
I just made up a word. Yeah, okay. I did. There's something now referred to as LCLA, low cost, low altitude. And it's the same concept of taking condemned personnel chutes or different things like that and using them for short notice airdrops to teams in the field as necessary. If someone's on the run, you got to come in and do a quick resupply as opposed to doing a large container delivery system or a heavy equipment drop or something like that. You need to get supplies to a remote team. This system has now been formalized and is in the books and now can be used for that purpose in wartime or any other scenario.
Yeah, so there's an innovation story and a story about sort of how systems get put into place, often from the bottom up, sort of from ground up initiatives of in this case, airmen on a mission, right?
Yep.
One last question, and this is something that I was wondering about as I was reading about Operation Christmas Drop, and that is, can you talk a little bit about what this means for the relationship between the United States and Guam and for the United States and these small island territories, like the Federated States of Micronesia or the Northern Mariana Islands and things like that?
I wouldn't think to speak to the intentions of the U.S. government or the State Department or the DOD for that matter, but obviously all of these missions are approved via the DOD. This is not some fly-by-night operation. This has been a standard that's been going on for many years. Formal flight orders are cut. Money is obviously expended for the training and for the humanitarian portion of it. The fact that we have the Denton program in the first place obviously is intentionally there for operations just like this. So I think it speaks well of the government and their willingness to go out and service areas that need resupply like this to be prepared for the worst case scenario when some of these islands will nearly disappear in the midst of a typhoon. They're so small. They're so close to sea level, obviously. I think it's a great, great effort on the part of the U.S. government and obviously the citizens of Guam and the Pacific Islanders there to look out for one another and take care of one another in times of need or, you know, to make sure that we're ready to go if that times of need ever exists.
Yeah, it seems to emphasize the connections between the United States and the rest of the world, even in these very isolated places. And of course, the U.S. still has some sort of sovereign status in the region with many of these Pacific islands, which is an important piece of American foreign policy and American presence.
Yeah, I mean,
to
give you an idea of the scope, in 2016 they went out and they hit about 54 islands, I believe it was, and they dropped about 43,000 pounds of all those supplies that I was talking about earlier. Back in 2007, they actually went out and hit a high of about 74 different islands. So we're not talking about just hitting the atoll of Kapiti-Merengue anymore like it was in 1952. It has grown into a major operation, as I've explained, right. And it's gotten rather vast.
And probably something that the islanders come to expect and rely on really for supply and some of their basic needs on the island.
Yeah, very definitely.
Because, right, travel and communication is so difficult when you're talking about that expanse of ocean. I mean, just miles and miles and miles of nothing but blue water between these places.
It is incredible to see a little rock pop up in the middle of nowhere as you're right. driving out over this beautiful blue ocean, and to realize that there are people that have lived on there for a long, long time, and they managed to thrive and survive.
Yeah. Very good. I maybe would like to think a little more about blue oceans and clear skies and tropical unhindered and uninterrupted paradises as we're getting ready to gear up for winter here in Pennsylvania.
It's not a bad place to be.
But thanks so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
And let's wish our listeners at home Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays wherever they are.
Merry Christmas.
Very good. Thanks.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.